you all sound like you're fairly good actors. So tell me, who were the first local musicians to find out the truth about the escapades?
I can tell you who I guess it is, and you see what you guys think. I think it was Jim Johnson. I think it was the Underbeats and those guys first, because I think once we had made our few performances and we were doing that first big thing at the Marigold and the second big thing at the Marigold for Marsh, I think that Dick Shapiro and Bill Deal leaked it out at that point. Because the next time, after we had done the two Marigold performances, where it was one like another week later, I noticed at the store, the guys are coming in, "So how's things going, Ron? Are you playing much?" And I mean, they were now pretty well had the idea.
They were chiding you is what they were doing. I want to point something else out that hasn't been touched on. But besides the wigs and the clothes, which we got at a place called Kiefer's in downtown Minneapolis, they had the most updated, hippest stuff. The boots were Italian boots. They were just like, you know, they were Beatle boots. They had all that stuff there in one place. We got all that stuff there. We had the wigs. We had the songs. We had the illusion. But the equipment was part of the plan, too. I had gotten rid of my Jazzmaster in favor of a Gibson 335, which looked similar to Harrison's Gretsch. I didn't want to play a Gretsch, but the 335 looked just like it, and Rico had one too. Terry had a Fender bass. Now, he didn't get a Vox, but he had a Fender bass, and I'm not sure. I think I was still using my Bandmaster at that time. But that was the completion of the illusion and the visual. We had to have the right equipment too. He had the same drum set.
I actually got...
Oh, did you get a new
drum
set?
Then I switched, when everybody switched their equipment, I mean, he really outfitted our whole group, and so then I got a Rogers drum set, the newest Rogers drum set.
And was that a popular British drum
set? No, well, but a lot of the British bands, a lot of the British drummers were using it.
They were.
Yes, and that was before some of the brands that are around now.
But our amplifiers, to my knowledge and remembrance, we were the first to set our speakers on the edge and then the tops on top of that. Nobody was doing that around here prior to our doing it.
What do you mean on the edge?
We turned them up. Instead of having them flat,
going horizontal,
we turned them on their side, so they were like a column, and then we put the head on top of that.
Everybody did it after that.
Yeah. Everybody did it.
First time I ever saw that done was when I saw Lonnie Mack at the prom, I think the prior summer, 64. Beyond that, I'd never seen it before.
So now on breaks, you guys would sort of hide in the dressing rooms?
Yeah.
We did not mingle.
And how did you keep people from coming in to the dressing room?
Our band boys, our bodyguards.
Yeah, you couldn't get to those dressing rooms anyway. Mr. Lucky's dressing room was off the side of the stage.
Okay.
So we just kept we really hid ourselves. And when we left places, like at the Dayton's Top 10 Club, when we were there and we played there at the Dayton's Top 10 Club, and we really had to be escorted and ushered aside because the young kids just didn't know, and they just were going crazy for this group. And it was really because of, I'd like to say it's because we were all so handsome in the group, but I'm pretty sure it had all to do with the fact that the English groups were popular and nothing to do with.
Yeah, I mean, there's like 70 some gigs in a 5 month period. I mean, that's a lot of playing, but that was typical back then.
That's more than 5 months, isn't it?
It's from January till July, mid July.
You notice how they start to really bunch up here, get closer almost every day there.
Right.
You guys used to be unhappy with me, I'd say.
I mean, was kind of typical then, because when I was in the accents, our schedule was like that. It was like every day.
Yeah, but ours was better.
This was after the fact.
So how long was it before The Secret came out?
I'm just going to guess, and let's see what the other guys say. I would guess that that we were into March or April, certainly maybe March of that year. Maybe into April. I do know that was, I think we had a good 3 months or so.
It was close to summer. I remember that because towards the end, we weren't wearing the wigs anymore. Our hair had gotten to the point where they weren't as long as the wigs, but they weren't a normal haircut anymore. And by then they knew we were, you know, that whole thing had blown over, but gradually, it wasn't a big shock thing. It just gradually, they realized, you know,
We made the change, I think it was at Danceland where we stopped wearing the wigs, as I recall, and we kind of let it be known that now we were going to change, you know, we were going to maybe dress a little different and no more wigs. But our hair was grown out enough so that we still fit in with the period.
The whole time period from December 64 to July 65, you still maintained the British songs?
Yeah.
No, or the British songs, I'm sorry.
No, that didn't change. But I noticed on there, I had said something about you were in the hospital, Terry.
The last two gigs? Jobs well,
who
I was.
Who did we have playing bass?
I'm so surprised when
Bill
you
Bill Stranlaw.
We did?
Yep.
Are you serious?
Bill covered it for me on bass at least one of the nights. Wow.
I think he did both. I did not remember until he told me this, but I remember he had gotten sick. You know, he was out kissing too many girls, and he picked up something. No, I'm kidding. And
probably true.
Yeah, it could have been. And then we had a fill-in, but until he said who it was, and then I remember Stranlaw coming and rehearsing with us, Tom.
Wow, I completely forgot about that.
Now, you're being booked both by Shapiro and Marsh Edelstein?
We're being booked by... I'm open to taking bookings and working with any of the booking agents, but no one could use us completely.
Okay.
I booked us as open. So if the guy that owned the ballroom in Rochester called me up and wanted to book a date direct, we would book it direct. If Shapiro was only booking it or Marsh, then I wouldn't take the job from them. But I said...
We were non-exclusive with the agencies.
Did they want you exclusive?
Yes, well, everybody sure did. It. Yeah.
But we wouldn't let them have it. So they either had a choice to don't be involved or take it the way we wanted it.
What we did was I said to them, at the one point it got real stressful because the guys were pushing so hard. They said, well, then we're not going to book you at all. We'll make sure you don't work in this place and that place. And I said, I'll tell you what. Whoever gives us the most bookings that we like, we'll give them first choice on dates. And so I turned it around on them, and they could have either gotten together and tried to push us out, but they all liked that they could say that the Escapades are a group that booked with them.
Plus that they wanted the money, and they knew there was money to be made, so they weren't about to just walk off and not take any of it.
Terry, did you have a favorite club that you liked to play at in town?
I think I liked Danceland as much as any of them.
Big Red.
It had a big open feel to it. It was just comfortable, and I was awed playing there. It was just a couple of years before that I saw my favorites in 63, the Everly Brothers and the Ventures. So that place held a lot of esteem for me to play there.
Did you back up Big Reggie on Cotton Fields?
No. I mean, some of the groups did. It never came up with us. Okay. I don't know. It's good. Maybe it had something to do with us playing English music. Might have been it. I don't know why. Did you guys know that was his big deal?
When I played there with the Accents and the Litter and some of the groups that I was in, I never ran across that at all. I didn't even know he did that.
Ron and Zippy, did you guys have a favorite place to play with
them? I really liked Lucky's because that was the hot spot in town, and it was always packed to the gills when we were there, and it was I mean, I liked all the gigs, but that Lucky's in particular was my favorite. I liked the sound in there. I liked the whole ambience of the place.
I can only say I had two favorites. I had the Prom Ballroom, and I have to admit I loved playing at Danceland. There was, as Terry said and Tom said, there was something special about it that was different than any place else. But I couldn't pick one over the other. They each had things I liked, and that was my favorites.
Yeah, I mean, they were all great. But for me, Lucky's, and I like Danceland, too, obviously. But and I wound up playing there quite a bit later with the Litter, and I liked it even more then.
I see here you've got the Hopkins Roller Rink on your list. What are the acoustics like in a roller rink?
Terrible.
They're very good if you have roller skates on during the show and if there's ice anywhere nearby, but otherwise it's...
Roller rinks, armories, those kinds of places were always really echoey. I always hated them for that reason.
Ford Union Hall was like that too. It was just everything echoed. They didn't know about acoustics.
I hated playing gigs at places that were echoey because it was hard to get a good idea of how your balance was and how you were sounding, and... I mean, but there were some really prestigious gigs to be had in those places, and you did them, but they weren't my favorite places.
Did you even have a sound man?
Us? The Escapades?
The Escapades.
No.
A light show?
PA, no. That was before all that stuff. And PAs, PAs were...
We were testing new ones all the time.
Yeah, were Bogan amplifiers through a Fender bottom or something. I mean, they didn't have any kind of real PA systems.
And you couldn't use the PA systems very well at most places, because they didn't understand acoustics well.
They didn't have PAs other than what would come through the top of a ceiling right. or something. They didn't have these big setups like places do now. That was way before all of that.
And did you do any battle of the bands?
We did. We did eventually a number. We chose not to. I really chose not to book us into some. But we did do some along the way. And I believe you'd have to tell me for sure if we were on some shows with the Accents or the Chancellors or the Underbeats or one of those groups, then there very possibly was
called a battle. But it was never a thing where we played with four or five other bands. Usually no. Somebody would open for us, or we'd do an even thing with one or two other groups at the most. And it wasn't very often.
Chancellors, TC Atlantic.
Yeah, yeah. It wasn't very much, though. Most of the time it was just us with an opening act.
The Avanis,
we never opened for anybody but Chuck Berry. They always opened for us, if I remember correctly.
Now, did the band do any recording or any live recordings?
Nope. We went into a bar on Lake Street towards the end because we were starting to get into some originals, and we just went in during the day. It wasn't a gig, and we played live some of the originals on a reel-to-reel, and nobody knows what happened to those tapes.
Who was writing the originals?
Rico and I.
Do you remember some of the titles?
What was that one title, Terry?
I don't know the title of it.
I Own Her. That was one of the titles.
Okay.
We didn't have a lot of them. I think we had four or five, and we recorded them.
We had, Rico had written a song called I Want to Hold Your Hand, but somebody had already used that, so that one was put aside.
But seriously, we only had a few, you know. I think I wrote one, and I can't remember what the name of it was.
So, Ron, you've got the date list there. Mm-hmm. What were the final couple jobs of the Escapades?
Well, it's fun to see this because I had forgotten what the final dates were, but we ended up in the month of July. We started it out in an American Legion Hall in Wayzata. We played Danceland. We played Schlieff's Little City. We played Rice Lake, Wisconsin. We played at the Playmore in Rochester. We played locally here at the Safari Club. We played in Jordan, Minnesota. And the last two was the Marigold Ballroom, and that was a pretty good show. I can remember that. And then Danceland, which was also good. And they were all well attended. So when we were done, we had gone out on a high note. Terry didn't get to be at the last couple jobs because of an illness, and he missed out on it. But it was when we were done, we could honestly say we were unhappy that it was over, but we really went out on a high note,
yes,
I think.
He couldn't go out any higher than that. And just so that people, and I assume people are going to be listening to this online, right? Okay. That people might find it interesting to know that when Terry was laid up for a little while there, that Bill Strandloff, who went on to be the lead guitar player before I was the lead guitar player, filled in for him on bass. Kind of an ironic setup there, you know, of who was doing what.
And just for the record, Ron, what's the date of the last job at Danceland?
The last job at Danceland was July 13th. Of 1965.
Okay, and that brings version one of the Escapades to an end, correct?
Yes.
So what's the next chapter in the Escapades?
At that point, everybody went their own separate ways. Rico went to the Underbeats. Tom, you went to...
Frog and His Friends.
And you went...
The latter part of 65, we tried out some other musicians.
I decided I wanted to continue the Escapades.
So looking back at the first version of the Escapades, was there a highlight for each of you, Terry?
The highlight, I think, was our sound, our accepted sound, the way people not only liked our choice of material, but the level at which it was performed. And that, to me, was the high point of my experience with the group.
Ron?
I think the highlight for me in kind of a combination is the fact that we started right out with someone as big as Chuck Berry and got associated with the quality and the level of musicianship that he had, and that he, having just come off of being on the road with the Beatles for him, all of a sudden the next job was, in a sense, with us, the Escapades. And along with that, the high point of it was that we kept hitting all the right spots, the right people, the right things all the way through. We played this much more professionally than we had experienced before. And it was truly a taste of a bigger thing than just a little local group. I think that whole experience, any one of us that was involved in it, would have been missing a huge hole in our lives, no matter what came after, if we hadn't have been in that group.
And Zippy?
Well, for me, it was the stepping stone between the local kid unique group and what I went on to do later professionally was all because of the Escapades. Because what it did for me, the highlight in one respect was just the excitement of those level of gigs, of professionalism, but it gave everybody in the group, and me included, credibility mm-hmm. that we didn't have before. That credibility led me to all the other stuff, including the litter and the really good stuff that happened later. And so for me, that was the highlight, the level of professionalism that we got, because I agree with Terry, the sound was really good. I mean, we had it down, and the credibility that came with it. The notoriety was fun, but for me, the important thing was the credibility, because up to then, we were just a bunch of kids from St. Paul and the Uniques. Now we were somebody that was not only a force to be reckoned with as a group, but as individual musicians got the credibility and the respect of being somebody that's good.
All right, we'll take a break and come back with the Escapades version 2.